You must be tired.
I am tired. Yeah. This was scheduled for an hour and a half hearing, and it was almost 7 hours. The judge was just as pissed as the rest of us.
Is that a good thing or a very bad thing?
I don't know. It's complicated. The result wasn't particularly interesting. Everyone got the judge affirmed the probable cause to detain them. They haven't been indicted yet, so there's not probable cause for a charge. But and probable cause is a low bar. It's not it's nothing slam dunk. I think that it's a sign that the state is realizing there's a lot of attention, and the state, I mean feds in this case, have a lot of attention.
So before you say more, is this the kind of stuff you want to get into on the show?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
I think I more want to get into, like, I think a lot of people have not heard the details about the case.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of like, and they don't really know. They know, like, something weird is happening in Dallas.
Yes.
They don't realize that, like, this is not a Dallas problem. We are a part of a very large process that's going to impact everybody else.
All right. So let's start the show with that. Welcome back to the podcast. I don't know if you heard, Alex, but we are changing our name for a not unrelated reason.
A not unrelated reason. Oh, interesting. Okay. I want to hear. I'd like to hear about that at some point.
Well, you can probably figure it out.
It's just I understand.
A bit of a sketchy name in this time, and we never really liked it that much. But yeah, so Sean will be back on the show probably this week, and we'll talk about our new branding. Today we're going to talk about something else we talked about last week on the show, this new repression on the left that we're starting to see emerging from the Trump administration. We're starting to see how it's shaping up. It looks like, from what I've read so far, the main target initially is going to be nonprofits and NGOs. But of course, there's this intensification of a continuous process of political prosecutions, specifically against anarchists, anti-fascists, and anti-ICE activists. And on this topic, I want to make a quick recommendation before we get into the show today. The Final Straw Radio Show did a really great interview with lawyer Maura Meltzer-Cohen. And I really think everybody who is worried about this or just thinking about it or want to understand the legalities of it, check out that show. There is a link in the show notes. But today we're going to talk about one particularly grim test case that's been unfolding since the 4th of July, and that is of the Prairie Land 10. Is that how we're referring to these defendants?
It's more than 10, so we're calling them just the Prairie Land defendants.
The Prairie Land defendants, and we're joined by Alex from Dallas-Fort Worth. So yeah, maybe just introduce yourself a little bit, how you got involved in this case, and tell us the story.
Yeah, so my name is Alex. I'm with the DFW Support Committee. We're a committee of family and friends, of loved ones, of defendants in this case. It's a very complicated case that I think has not percolated, in part because it's complicated. You mentioned 10. It's actually the full number of 17. It all stems out of a protest that happened on July 4th outside the Prairie Land Detention Center, which is in a small town called Alvarado, which is about an hour south of Fort Worth. Everything's bigger in Texas, so, you know, DFW is a huge
place. It is huge. I have been there.
It's
the only place I've been where I took a bus somewhere, and I got dropped off at, like, a park and ride and had to run across the highway to get off. to get back into the town.
This is your mistake for trying to take public transit. Dallas is getting Waymo soon, so we'll see how that goes for the Waymo. All right,
sorry for that diversion.
Yeah. Anyway, so the protest took place at the Prairie Land Detention Center in Alvarado, which is in Johnson County, which is a kind of a mostly rural county. It was a noise demo, as many listeners might be familiar with, which is a style of protest where, often happens at prisons or jails and stuff like that, and the goal is to make a lot of noise and have your presence known to the people inside to show solidarity with them.
Yes, I've been to many of these. All the ones I've been to have been extremely peaceful. I mean, they're noisy, but there's no attempt at direct action or anything like that. And the most heartening thing about it, for those who have never experienced it, is the prisoners will flicker their lights on and off or wave to you and, express their appreciation that someone has come and shown some support.
Yeah, so at this particular noise demo, you know, there were fireworks. It was the 4th of July. There were, you know, bullhorns and kind of stuff. This is. I wasn't there, and everyone who I know who is allegedly there is currently in jail. So I don't have any firsthand knowledge, but from court documents, from sort of other statements, this is kind of our sense of what it was. It does seem that something happened. The state's allegation is that somebody fired a gun at a police officer and hit them. The cop was struck allegedly somewhere in the neck area, but at the same time, the cop was released from the hospital by the next morning. So, you know, wasn't in the hospital for less than a few hours. So I don't know. You know, well, I don't know what happened.
That's very fortunate. I'm glad they're doing okay.
Right. Yes. Glad that we're all happy that everyone survived this. But we, anyway, so the when the police responded to that, they rounded up everybody they could find, and became convinced, the cops became convinced that this was not a protest, that this was an organized ambush, and charged everybody with terrorism. And then a few days later, the feds got involved and charged everybody with 3 counts of attempted murder, with, you know, demonstrating no evidence that, you know, any of those individual people who were charged with attempted murder attempted to murder somebody, just that they were a part of this this attack, you know, this ambush, quote unquote. And over the next week and a half or so, one person who the cops believe was there at the protest was not apprehended, and there was a manhunt. Just to give you a sense, I mean, this was a very scary experience here in DFW. You know, we were seeing on the news, FBI most wanted kind of thing. They actually sent a push alert, a blue alert, not an amber alert, a blue alert to people's phones in Dallas and Houston and Oklahoma City and I think San Antonio.
Is that like an officer down sort of thing?
It was like, it was a, we're looking for this person, Benjamin Song, okay. You know, do you know where this person is, kind of thing. And so that person was apprehended about a week and a half later, and then a number of people were charged in relationship to allegedly hiding this person. And one of the wild things, I mean, this sort of the creep of repressive force that this entailed is, I think, startling. We should all really think about it. Like, one person who's the spouse of one of the defendants got arrested for allegedly having a box of zines that the state alleges was in the defendant's house, and they were cleaning the house and getting rid of evidence. And this box of anarchist literature was somehow evidence of a conspiracy to murder cops. And then another person was arrested. And this guy has never even gone to Johnson County, and he got arrested with the allegation that he removed somebody from chats. And that's the allegation. You know, not that he deleted messages, not that he, you know, burned notes or anything, just remove someone from a chat. And that is their evidence that he's hindering the prosecution of terrorism. And so that all totals up to 17 people. And they're all, one of them is out. The person who this chats thing is fortunately out on bail. He was able to get his bond reduced. People got crazy bonds. The highest bond was $15 million. That's for the person who had the manhunt around. Everyone else had like $10 million bonds. Wow. From that point, you know, this all happened first couple weeks of July. Now we're in the last couple weeks of September, and legally the case went nowhere. It just sort of stands still, and the people were rotting in a shitty county jail in a shitty county. And when I say this is a shitty county jail, the cops forced somebody to give birth in their cell.
Oh my God.
Because they didn't believe that this woman was going into labor.
One of the defendants? I mean,
not one of the defendants.
Okay, just another thing that happened.
Another person. This is just sort of, this is kind of the thing, right? Like, we're out here protesting the conditions of people in jail and our carceral system and all that kind of stuff. And Johnson County in Texas is a great example of what's wrong with our quote-unquote criminal justice system.
Yeah. You know, I saw Shakur had to go through something like that. Just thinking about that because she passed away this week. I think she had to give to birth. But I think they let her go to a hospital for a week or something.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah, yes, this person they did not believe, and I think this person probably didn't have the kind of support network outside that Assata Shakur had at that time to kind of advocate for them. Working class life.
And you said shitty jail. Another story that I read from the NLG statement about this, and the NLG strongly condemned everything about this case. Maybe we'll get into some of that. But they said that one of the defendants was forced to clean a wall of feces that was caked on their holding cell from the previous inmate. Yep. So,
These are
horrifying conditions.
And degrading strip searches. You know, this is not a new thing for people who have gone to jail, but this kind of, you know, they wake people up in the middle of the night, to defendants in the middle, these are the defendants, wake them up in the middle of the night and have them strip out, and which includes, you know, I don't want to go into detail, but it's gruesome, you know, a strip search is a strip search. And, you know, these people were in bed. It was 4 a.m.
And they're in solitary.
Some
of them are in solitary, exactly. Yeah.
No, they were all in solitary, yeah.
So, just treating these people as harshly as possible for something that, I don't know the detail. All I know is what I've read on the news, and you're going to tell us more about it. But when I first heard about it, the media was sort of, or like there was rumors that was sort of like breaking to the media that like there had been a sniping, like something that we heard about last week at the same facility in Dallas.
Not the same facility, but also in Dallas.
Oh, okay. I thought it was, all right, so another ICE facility in Dallas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that was something more like a real ambush. And then when I heard about more details, it's like, okay, it sounds like this was a noise demo and something almost certainly separate happened from it. And now they're just going after everyone at the noise demo and then another layer of people who weren't even there.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other important thing about this, and I left off the story by saying we were in this sort of legal waiting period. Texas has a crazy thing where if you're charged with a felony, they have 90 days to indict you if you're in custody. If you're not in custody, they have statute of limitations, but they have 90 days, and we were just getting out 90 days. And then last week, they got transferred into federal custody. And now just today, just this morning, or today, it was started this morning, it ended not too long ago. They had what's called a preliminary hearing in Fed custody, where the feds had to justify that they have probable cause to continue holding these people. And it was the first time in any public context that the government had to supply any kind of evidence to demonstrate their case. And it was very revealing. One of the things that came out, and I think this is, I think, really important for the show and maybe ties into this name thing that you're mentioning, is they made a very big deal about Antifa. And they made that was their narrative about what this organized group was who was planning a terroristic act or whatever. And they had specific organizations, which are real organizations or real groupings or projects that exist in DFW, but it was all under this banner of Antifa. And as far as I know, this is the first public legal case since the executive order or the executive action, whatever it was, that came out last week, pushing this narrative from the White House that Antifa is the enemy, is some kind of cultic, you know, terroristic, you know, or movement or something. And today we saw it in full public display, even to the extent of showing a number of the defendants had commercial printers in their garage, you know, where they allegedly printed zines, anarchist zines. And this, for the state, was evidence of their participation in the conspiracy. They called them the philosophical leaders.
Wow.
For distributing, you know, literature that many of your viewers might have read. You know, for example, they showed on the screen the Crime Think piece Safer in the Front, and talked about how this idea of Safer in the Front and being on the attack, quote unquote, is evidence that these people were basically urban guerrillas. I mean, I didn't use that word, but that's kind of the other historical word that they would use.
So, that's interesting that Antifa is like their sort of overarching menace to that, because there's this narrative out there that Antifa is not a real thing. It's just an ideology. There's no organizations. And there have been real Antifa organizations and networks. As far as I can tell, in the United States, they don't exist anymore. There maybe some are, but the ones that I was familiar with in the Trump's first administration are no longer active. But then the myth that was kind of spread through right-wing media has persisted to some degree, and that they brought that back on the federal level for this terrorist designation. And I think a lot of law enforcement officers believe it. They believe that Antifa is this funded network of like paid pro, like the from Ed, I don't know if you saw Eddington, but like it's like the Eddington narrative that there really are Antifa super soldiers that are trying to behead white children in the town square, and so they're going with that for the prosecution. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that it's there's another wrinkle to this, which is really plays into the deranged fantasies of Trump and the at this point mainstream right wing. A number of these events were trans. Mm. And so you've got these trans Antifa super soldiers coming into a small town to kill cops. I mean, I remember back in 2020, there was all this panic, in small town Idaho, they thought Antifa from Portland was going to come and, attack their local police officer, and they had their militia out to protect against, this whole sort of boogeyman of Antifa being coming to small towns to kill cops. This is perfect bait for them. In my opinion, I mean, I don't have any knowledge that's not public or anything, but I just from what I know from what I've seen of the case, there's no substance here, but they're going to make a meal out of it. And that's why this case, the Prairie Land case, was the first bullet in the press release that went along with Trump's executive action.
Right,
said,
I remember that.
Here are these examples of Antifa, attacks, we were right up there.
So how did the judge receive the, you said earlier that it took all day, you thought it'd be short. What was the judge reaction to this stuff?
Well, the judge was, I don't have a lot of experience with reading judges and how judges react whenever. To me, he seemed pretty even-keeled and professional. He did seem frustrated that this was taking so long. At various points, he kind of looked at the prosecution and said, do you need to make this point? he said it to the defense a couple of times, the different defense attorneys a couple of times too, but I think it was clear that this was something unusual. And in the end, he did decide that there was probable cause to detain people, which is not terribly surprising given that, probable cause is a pretty low bar,
Yeah, at this stage of the proceedings, you don't have to back up everything you're saying, it's very early. There's often a lot of exaggeration in the state's case at this stage in the
trial.
What are some more, I don't know how many other specifics you want to get into, but something that could, things that we learned about how the state was investigating or what they were looking for in terms of evidence.
Yeah, another thing that I think is very relevant to activists these days is the use of Signal in the state's case as evidence of a conspiracy. It's funny, one of the defense attorneys literally tried to get the state's witness to acknowledge that even Pete Hegseth is using Signal. I mean, mm-hmm. I know it was a Signal clone or whatever, but it was kind of a funny moment. So the use of Signal as an encrypted messaging app that is reputable. I mean, the Signal, what they call the Signal protocol or the Signal standard, is now sort of spread beyond Signal. Other platforms use it, but the use of Signal and encrypted messaging for the state at this hearing this morning was a big part of its narrative for, what were they clearly, they were trying to hide something, and clearly this was not just a peaceful protest, because why would you be afraid of the government knowing about your peaceful protest? Another interesting moment, that's kind of a tangent to that, but one of the defense attorneys was cross-examining the FBI agent who was on the stand, kind of giving the evidence, and asked the guy point blank, do you believe that police attack protesters? And the FBI said, no, absolutely not. Police never attack protesters.
Wow.
There's this, I think that if you walk around kind of talking to people in North Texas, you probably would get that opinion from a lot of people, you know, this sort of default acceptance of authority. And I think that in other places, you know, or New York or Portland or whatever, there's a little more sense of like, I don't know, like sometimes the cops do something a little out of pocket. And sometimes you need to protect yourself from the cops. I mean, we're seeing the videos out of Chicago are both very inspiring and kind of scary, right? I mean, you're seeing people being thrown to the ground and tear gas being fired. And I know, I mean, it's kind of a goofy thing where even the mayor is kind of accusing them of assault or whatever. It's kind of accusing the ICE agents of assault or whatever. But it's a funny situation. But I think the videos right now, I think a lot of people are seeing the realities of what protest is like.
Is this a big story in Dallas? Like, do you get a sense that everyone knows about this?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, I think that a lot of people knew about it when they got the push alert to their phone. And there's been coverage at these various points. I mean, one of the things we're a legal defense committee. We're trying to support our defendants to get the best legal defense possible. For us, a big part of that is making sure that there's public spotlight on it, you know? So, we're making sure there's press releases. We're trying to go on podcasts. We're trying to, you know, spread the word that like this case matters, not just to our friends and our family and our people, and not just to activists in DFW, but activists far and wide, and not just activists. I think, you know, my neighbors, right? My neighbors are ill prepared for a authoritarian turn in our government, you know.
But the charges at this point are all state charges.
No, the charges are still. The legal situation. They have both state. They have both a state and a federal case.
Okay.
They are not indicted on either one. And they were sitting in that Johnson County jail on the state charges until last week, and now they're in federal custody. The timelines are confusing and whatever legal stuff. I'm not a lawyer, but there's timelines. I think it's like a month or something that the state has to indict. Mm.
And so this is obviously a really horrifying case, and it's important for us to know about it, because even if you are a pacifist, even if you are just reformist critic of prisons, even if you go to the No Kings protest, for example, something bad could happen there that has nothing to do with you and get wrapped up on this. And this is why it's really important that we follow this case and understand how it's going to play out. And so what were some of the defense arguments in this today in court?
Well, a lot of the defense arguments were kind of along the lines of what you said about, you know, where is the evidence that each defendant actually did any of the things that they are alleging they did. And one of the new developments that happened here, if people are following the case, they might remember there was this confusing, like, you know, one or three or multiple shooters kind of thing when it first came out. And the state said very clearly they only believe there was one person who fired a gun. They allege that person is Benjamin Song. But they have to kind of make this rhetorical loop-de-loops to claim that now everybody is responsible for that firing of a gun that they allege is happening.
And Benjamin Song was, one of the things I read was he was allegedly away from the protests, like in the woods or something.
Yeah. They have a lot of maps, and they, you know, one of the things they didn't show was active CCTV camera. You know, they have all the CCTV camera, but they didn't play it at the hearing. You know, they just showed stills. But there's they allege that Song was sort of off in a stand of trees and then sort of fired and then retreated into someone's yard and then fired again. And it's a little confusing sort of map wise, like, was this, you know, and then there's other people who, you know, were arrested down the, like two blocks away, you know, that, you know, they have whatever, this is a legal evidence, yada, yada, yada. But that kind of thing, when you ask what the defense arguments were, it was kind of this, like, well, what do you have there? And, you know, there's things, there's these gunshot residue tests, and there's sort of evidence that, you know, people may or may not have touched a gun or something. And, you know, one thing that I didn't mention is that there were a number of guns that were picked up, you know, were, found at the scene and at people's homes and stuff. But this is Texas, right? Yeah, like Texas. People having guns at their home is not a crime, and people having guns at a demo, I mean, that's unfortunately not unfortunately. I don't want to be too strong about that, but it is a fact of protest these days, and it does happen. I mean, people go to demonstrations with a gun. I mean, just that's a common occurrence.
That would certainly make me very uncomfortable, but I'm from New York, you know. It's a different story up here. But yeah, there's that case from Austin 2020 or 2021 where this fascist came to a protest specifically to kill or assault protesters. And I think, do you know this story?
From Austin, I don't remember the Austin one in particular. No, I don't.
But he was, so the fascist killed someone, like one of the protesters who was armed. And claimed self-defense, but didn't hold up in court. He was convicted, and then the governor was trying to, and I think probably successfully, commuted the sentence.
Yeah.
Pardon the guy.
Right. Yeah.
Just because he was on his side in that act of violence.
Right.
It was horrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have the other example from the No Kings protest in the spring in Salt Lake City, where that person was unfortunately killed.
Oh, yeah.
And they're charging not the person who fired, but the person who was fired upon. That might have gotten thrown out. I don't remember. I haven't followed that in
detail. That was another really ugly story, as was what happened at the end of the Chaz Chop in Seattle. So, and this is just my New Yorker bubble opinion, but I don't know about guns at protests. I understand people are trying to defend themselves. They're in a different context than I understand, but I'm worried about stuff like this happening.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of defending yourself for guns or whatever, one of the things the states used as evidence was the fact that people at the protest had first aid kits that were a little more than a normal first aid kit. They were things that you would use to stop a gunshot wound, bleeding, you know, a tourniquet or something like that. And in 2025 in DFW, I mean, I think that's a good thing to have in your car at any time. Mm. You know, this is America, you know, being prepared for gun violence should be something that we're all prepared for. Unfortunately, yeah. I do not support the fact that we are seeing gun violence as a very normal part of our political system. That's terrible. But having a first aid kit to save someone's life is a good thing, you know, but the state is twisting this into some sort of conspiracy that, you know, they were expecting violence, and how dare they expect violence when, you know, it's the ICE agents and the, you know, the mass kidnappers in the street who are bringing violence to the street, in my opinion.
Well, how you're laying this out, it seems like the state's going to be doing more walkbacks, and the defense is going to get more evidence, and hopefully some of these people are going to get out soon. What's the next step in the process?
Well, the next step in the process is trying to make that happen. You know, we need lawyers, we need all that stuff that helps people. We've had a fundraiser up since the beginning of the since the protest, since this happened, since people got arrested. And if people want to support and help cover things like, you know, private attorneys and other things that support people's legal case and having a good defense, we are more than happy to have that. We're also having a day of solidarity this Friday. Well, I'm not sure when it's going to come out, but
tomorrow.
We're having a day of solidarity this Friday, October 3rd, internationally, and we're just asking people to do something in your community to raise awareness about the case, to build solidarity with your people, and, you know, let us know. I'll share your the committee email. We want people want to let us know so we kind of have a sense of where it's at. We love to have a little nice big map with little dots everywhere to show all the great support we're getting. But yeah, I think that, you know, historically, right, if you think back to the Green Scare, if you think back to, you know, all the long history of political cases we have, that kind of community popular public support really makes a difference in terms of how these things go. People get railroaded all the time in our court system. All these true crime podcasts are so popular right now because it's like, oh, did they really do it? I don't know. This case seems kind of weak, you know? If we don't want this situation to become a podcast 10 years from now, people looking back being like, I think those people were innocent. It's the attention and solidarity right now that's going to make that difference.
Yeah. It's a very scary case. And you know, I certainly have, you know, part of my initial feeling when I saw it is like, I don't want to touch this. But as these details came out that it sounds like this was not some armed struggle group. This was people at the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, I think it's really important that we do pay attention, and if we feel strongly about it, support their legal defense. We saw, for example, how the RICO case in Atlanta is falling apart. It's not over. There's still people facing really serious charges. But if you've got capable lawyers and you've got people supporting the defendants, there is a possibility that justice will come out on the right side.
Well, I think that, you know, we have a system that justice comes out on the right side for rich people all the time, right side, quote unquote. You know, they get the best legal defense possible. And folks like us, you know, in the movement and working class people, like, we don't have lawyer money, right? And the way we're gonna get a fair shake is through solidarity.
Mm. I'll bring up another case that some people might have heard of. This was of Casey Goonan in the Bay Area. They lit maybe a cop car on fire, tried to do a couple other acts of vandalism. I haven't looked too closely into what they're alleged to have done, but I don't think anybody was hurt or close to being hurt in solidarity with Palestine. So they were being charged with similar terroristic charges, and Casey Goonan was trying to cooperate and make a plea agreement. They were facing 20 years in prison plus 15 years of supervised release. And Casey Goonan said that basically he did this. He's sorry. He was going through a mental health crisis at the time. He is willing to do some time. He acknowledges what he did was wrong. And the judge still threw the book at him and gave him almost the maximum sentence. He's facing 20 years plus 15 supervised release for doing something that didn't hurt anybody. So I'll put information about that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, I think that's a very important example, especially because it's kind of showing the sign of the times. I mean, back in 2020, a lot of those cases got thrown out. You know, a lot of cases in a lot of places did not go forward from all the protest stuff that happened. And we're in a kind of different scenario now. And I don't think that should scare people. I think that should just raise the bar for what kind of commitment people have to fighting for our rights and fighting for freedom. You know, another example that reminds me of that is also a local struggle that hasn't got much national thing is a case around a Palestinian activist or pro-Palestine activist here in DFW named Ronak Alam, who got arrested for graffiti. He wrote "Fuck Israel" on a church in a DFW area suburb. Got found, they added hate crime to the case. And he had a jury trial, and he won the hate crime. They found it was not a hate crime. The jury actually sided with the protester, and the judge still sentenced him to 6 months in jail. The judge overruled he didn't overrule the conviction, but he overruled the sentencing suggestion from the jury and sent us into 6 months in jail.
Wow.
There was an appeal release or whatever, and he got rearrested. I think he's been arrested something like 3 or 4 times now. It's a situation where I think the political climate of these courts are not, you know, really in our favor. And so the game to actually courts, a lot of what they're trying to do is maintain the legitimacy of the court system. You know, that's part of the judge's job. And I think in 2020, we saw that because they knew that there was popular support for the protesters. And if they threw the book at everybody, people would think twice about supporting the courts. But now I think that, like, we're seeing the powers that be are assuming that there is sort of popular support for this right-wing authoritarian turn, and there's not. And the more we show that, the more we change that center of gravity and momentum, the better we're going to be off in these legal situations.
Yeah, and this is a part of the reason I recommended that Final Straw radio interview with Maura Meltzer Cohen, because she's very clear that, like, this rhetoric that's coming out from the Trump administration, law enforcement, is very concerning, very scary. But even with that, you still have rights to free speech. You still have rights to protest. And obviously a big part of this is a chilling effect. And in a way, we should be chilled. We should be very thoughtful about what we say, about what we want publicly on podcasts, on social media. Certainly, like, if you look at what happened in 2020, and a lot of people are in prison for that, but compared to the millions of people who participated, you know, it's a drop in the bucket. It's still, you know, these are still people should be supported. And I'll put the show notes for the Uprising Prisoner Defense in the show notes as well.
Yeah, that's great.
You make a very good point that, you know, in the context of a mass nationwide struggle, it's harder to single people out.
And yeah, it's very ironic that the federal government put that safer in the front piece as part of their evidence today, because I think the sentiment is really good, you know, that this idea of hiding, this idea of, oh, I just, you know, I'm just going to go hide under my bed, you know, and wait for it to pass and not do anything to poke the bear is a losing strategy, you know. And, you know, it's our job to you know, I fully believe the Trump regime is brittle right now. You know, I don't think that they're in a strong position, and it's up to us, the people, the masses, all of us, to fight for the freedoms that we deserve and, you know, we need to have.
Maybe we can move away from the Prairie Lands defendants for a second and talk a little bit about the shooting that happened last week. What's the mood been in Dallas since then? Or, you know, have you seen anything, any repercussions of that?
I only have the public information on that. You know, this, you know, as a local person in Dallas, I would say it was very shocking. I mean, I remember sending messages to people being like, what the hell is happening? Like, what is happening? It's very strange. I mean, I think that the profile of this guy, from a north suburb of, you know, growing up in the north suburbs of DFW, white kid, you know, I don't want to speculate about his political stuff, but I will say that, you know, these are alienating places. You know, Allen, Texas, I would say, is an alienating place. The results of decades of white flight and, you know, creating these little enclaves of, where people can, you know, play their right-wing homesteader dreams and stuff. That's a very toxic soup, you know? And I mean, it's not just this guy, right? Like, the political context in DFW, you've got some of the most egregious anti-trans ministers in this town. You've got, you know, war criminals, George W. Bush, living in this town. You know, you've got this a political context that I think is unfortunately a little bit more typical of the United States than I want it to be. But in terms of the shooting itself, it was very shocking. It's very tragic that the people who died, I mean, one of them was a father who, at least what I heard, it was a father who, soon to be father, his partner was pregnant. And, you know, a lot of the people, you were confused with the location. The ICE has a facility in the city. It's kind of close-ish to downtown, where they've been processing people who get picked up in the Dallas area. And now they're moving those people to Prairie Land. So this actually does have a direct Prairie Land connection, because they're no longer using that facility. They're moving people out to Prairie Land, which is, you know, there's a Palestinian woman who was, let me make sure that I get that right. But there was a story shortly before the protest in the Prairie Land defendant case, who was from the East Coast, who got sent there. So, you know, it's Yeah, it's a Palestinian woman. After 5 months, yeah. Anyway, so you know, it was shocking, and it's a gun violence thing too. You know, there's a lot of guns in this town, in this country, it's scary. I mean, you know, even a road rage incident could escalate. Yeah.
And so Texas is obviously extremely chauvinistic on the political level about these far right politics. Governor Abbott's one of the most chauvinistic. But it, you know, Texas has an interesting history because it is so heavily Latino. And do you get a sense that there's any sort of normal backlash against ICE? Are you seeing the kind of ICE raids and roundups in Texas or in Dallas that we were seeing in LA or now Chicago and around the country?
You know, we're starting to. I don't have sort of corroborated evidence and all this stuff, but in my social media feeds, you'll see people talking about, you know, ICE here at this apartment complex, or there was a claim at some there was a club. This I think there was a news story about recently of a club, restaurant that's a Latino culturally Mexican club, where DPD surrounded the club and ICE came. The Dallas Police Department surrounded the club, preventing people from leaving. ICE came and did a sweep of, I think it was workers. It was more like a workplace raid, although I'm sure, I don't know for a fact that none of the customers who were there. The thing about Texas being this sort of bastion of the right wing is that it is an extremely diverse state. You know, it's not only Mexicans and Latino people, it's, you know, Black folks, and lots of immigrants. I mean, it's very funny. There's a King of the Hill reboot this summer, but this King of the Hill vision of, like, actually the white block is becoming much less white, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, got their Laotian person and, you know, Native person, and it's sort of this sort of changing landscape. And for example, the Palestinian movement here in DFW has been very strong because there's a very large Palestinian community here. You know, you'll drive by. I remember driving by a mosque with a car caravan with enormous Palestinian flags, and a lot of those people were Palestinian, you know, or they were Arab in various ways. And there's a thriving Arab community here in Richardson, Texas. And I think that the part of the veracity of the Christian nationalist, you know, Greg Abbott, Ken Paxton coalition is realizing that, you know, Texas doesn't look the way that they are used to it looking, mm-hmm. you know? And there's a lot of hubris about this sort of right-wing turn of the Rio Grande Valley, quote unquote, right-wing turn of the Rio Grande Valley in the last election. And I mean, this redistricting thing that happened to people. Remember, those Texas was a big thing. It was very Democratic Party news, but you know, it's a gamble, right? So we have seen resistance. There's been some interesting protests. There's a protest against the ICE raids. I mean, just a few weeks before the Prairieland protests, there were protests downtown. There's a sort of constellation of immigrant rights organizations people opposing ICE, doing, you know, ICE watch kind of things in DFW. I don't know. I mean, I think we'll see. This is a place that has a long history of being resistant to mass movements. You know, this people don't necessarily have Dallas on the map, DFW on the map of, like, places where big protests happen. But, like, there was BLM protests, there was an Occupy, there's always sort of some reflection of it. And I don't know. I mean, we'll see if this time in history is different.
Yeah. A lot of people who are covering the terrorism designation and the assault on free speech more generally are talking about it like it's unprecedented. And in some ways it is. These are new tactics and, like, we're going to see how they play out. In some ways it's not. There have been two red scares, there was the two green scares, and through those, people fought for their rights, and people have fought for their rights under other conditions of repression. And it's, You know, this happened on the 4th of July, and the 4th of July, I think a lot of people on the left maybe don't like it because it's got these jingoistic overtones, but historically it was a revolutionary holiday where common people who believed in the egalitarian and internationalist pretenses of the American Revolution celebrated the 4th of July by making a lot of noise, setting off fireworks, getting really drunk. You know, the Tammany Society actually would parade around a guillotine and behead effigies of the aristocracy in solidarity with the French Revolution as the U.S. government was moving against the French Revolution. And so this is as much a part of American history as these really ugly moments of repression. And so it's no reason to stop now.
Yeah, and on a global level, one thing I've been saying to people is, you know, we've got to remember that authoritarianism and authoritarian government is extremely normal, mm-hmm. unfortunately. And a lot of people live extremely normal lives during it. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't change the fact that it's unacceptable and it's something that we have to resist, you know, mind, body, and spirit. And that freedom is something worth fighting for, you know, just because people can, you know, keep their job and, you know, maybe their TikTok feed gets worse, but, you know, it wasn't that good in the first place.
All right. We'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us, Alex. You've been in court all day. I'm sure I appreciate you making the time. I'm sure you're exhausted. One more thing I'll ask is send me all the links that I can put in the show notes so the listeners can get more information and keep following this case.
Yep, sounds good.
All right. Thanks for listening,
Thank
everybody.
You.